Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. Today, I have a great guest on. I enjoy talking with him. We're going to be talking about some really cool subjects. I'm going to let him explain them, so I'm going to bring him on right away. His name is Brent. So, Brent, welcome to the show.
Well, Nancy, thank you. As always, I've been looking forward to it.
Me too. I love talking about what we're about to talk about.
Yeah, what is it we're going to talk about? Oh, UFOs.
Yeah, we're going to talk about those UFO little dudes out there. So, Brent, before we start to do that, though, could you kind of explain to listeners a little bit about who you are and also talk about the paper that you do and stuff like that so people know who you are?
Okay, well, I live in Waynesboro, Tennessee, and I've been studying UFOs since 1967, and I edit an online magazine titled Alternate Perceptions, and we cover not only just the UFO phenomena, but all sorts of areas that are unexplained, psychic phenomena, Bigfoot, Mothman, you just name it. We get contributors with all sorts of stories, and we try to, you know, take it from many different perspectives and evaluate the evidence as scientifically and objectively as we can, and we put out an issue each month. The website is www.mysterious-america.net, and we've been online, I guess, about 6 years now, and I actually started as a paper publication back in 85, and my co-editor is Dr. Greg Liu, who is a nationally certified psychologist, and so we try to bring, you know, some critical judgment and some open-mindedness, though, too, to this really vast and complex and challenging groups of phenomena that I think are very important for us to try to better understand.
Well, I think it's very important. You know, there's a lot of people who are going to have different ideas. Some believe, of course, there's UFOs. Some believe that there are not. I personally believe that there are. I believe they've been here for a long, long time. I believe they visit us on a regular basis. But, you know, a lot of people seem to think, oh, this is just, you know, a hokey thing, and there's, you know, every time something comes out in the news, it's been disproved, and so it's just people trying to do things. So with the studies that you have done, Brent,
right,
do you find that a lot of the information that is being given to us as American citizens are fact or fiction?
Well, there's, you know, I think officially the authorities have down through the years not really done us justice. I mean, the Air Force investigation, the Project Blue Book that was terminated in 1967, really didn't adequately address the phenomenon. It was closed because the University of Condon had done a 2-year study called the Condon Committee because of Edward Condon, who was the physicist in charge of that particular investigation. It was supposed to be unbiased, but early on there were indications that he had already made up his mind, and a lot of the report, which was about 1,500 pages, was a lot of it was just a rehash of old Air Force reports and such, and so really didn't contribute a whole lot that was revealing, and I think we've lagged behind. It's interesting that a lot of our foreign governments now seem to be coming out with a lot of their reports, disclosing it openly to the public, and are tired, I think, of the long, you know, the questions and, you know, the censorship behind it. We're still, you know, not really doing too much in that department. I think we need to address it more and try to get a lot of these classified documents and people talking more openly and without, you know, the giggle factor so much. Yeah, I think it should be obvious now that just this year I've twice interviewed two different NASA astronauts, and a lot of the things they talk about UFOs and paranormal and such are things that many of the serious researchers in this field talk about, but they don't have, you know, the qualifications necessarily to be taken seriously by mainstream media and science. And yet I thought, you know, it's amazing. You know, Dr. Edgar Mitchell and Dr. Brian O'Leary here were, you know, two NASA scientists, astronauts who are very open and take this all very seriously. And, you know, how come they're not being questioned more, you know?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you'd mentioned that the other governments are finally kind of open their files. Why do you think our government is so, they're just so protective of not letting us know about stuff like this?
Well, I'm not sure just what it is. You know, early on, I think that the Air Force just felt kind of burdened with the responsibility of this back, you know, when it started in 1947, when there was a wave of sightings across the United States, and that our first, you know, reaction was that our thought was that our concern, military-wise, was that these were new weapons, maybe that were being tested and flown over our airspace by, you know, foreign governments, and so that was the major number one concern. And you know, within a few years, I think they decided that wasn't the case, and then the Air Force felt it was getting in the middle of the whole controversy of is it this or that, and didn't want to, you know, that was the province that wanted to give the science. It had done its job, but still, it was a while before they could get away from it. In the meantime, astronomer Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was, you know, a civilian consultant, and he was originally a strong skeptic, and so he did what he could to try to put the phenomenon down, but then, of course, later on in later years, he came out and admitted that he was very puzzled by quite a number of the cases. I think the Socorro, New Mexico UFO landing that was witnessed by a police officer was one that really shook him up. There were actual physical traces at the scene, and he began to look at it more and more seriously, I think, after that. And he also consulted with the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, Coral Lorenzen, Jim Lorenzen. They were the heads of that organization. Used to meet with them and talk about the phenomena. When he, after 1969, a few years after that, when the Air Force shut down their study, he opened up his own civilian group, which is still in existence, out in Evanston, Illinois, the Center for UFO Studies.
I'm going to have to look him up. He's close by.
Well, he passed away a few years ago, but the organization is still active. I met him back in September 1972. I stopped in at his home in Evanston and spent, I guess, about an hour talking with him, and his book, The UFO Experience, had just come out, in which he had classified UFO encounters in terms of close encounters of the first kind, second kind, and, of course, the third kind, which later became a Steven Spielberg movie. And I could tell he took it very, very seriously and was interested in pursuing it further. So.
Now, you also wrote a book called Visitors from Hidden Realms.
Yes.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit?
I had, you know, traveled around the country myself, and had interviewed quite a number of people in different states who had, you know, close encounters, sightings, visitations, and interviewed quite a number of researchers, and even people from other countries like Brazil and Peru, and so I put a lot of this information in Visitors, and tried to not only the modern reports, but also make comparisons to some of the stories that go back centuries, the lore and folklore, legends, texts of visitors, angelic visitors, beings, the jinn of the Muslim traditions, the trickster, the star people, the kachiner of the Native Americans, and so on. And they were, you know, a lot of your ancient shamanic cultures believe that they were, the heavens were inhabited. Many of your Native American tribes talk about the star people, the star visitors. So I explore that some in the book as well, and have explored it, of course, in recent months, more and more in my online magazine, Alternate Perceptions.
Are there, like, certain spots that there's more sightings that go on than other spots?
There seem to be locations that that maybe, you know, one of the interesting angles here is that that perhaps some of the ancient people recognized that there was something special, sacred, different about certain locations, that the energy was different, and there were things that happened that didn't happen at other locations, and they sometimes erected certain, you know, temples and things on some of these spots because of unusual phenomena, mysterious lights and visitations from beings that had occurred, or beings of light that occurred in past times. And many of the Native American sites, Indian mound sites and such, have been noted for having a lot of UFO paranormal activity. And it's, in fact, with the Hudson Valley sightings back in the 1980s, there was a tremendous wave of activity. And Dr. Heineken came and assisted in this investigation. There were hundreds of sightings, and he had told one of the primary investigators in this this case that they needed to look for a window, that sometimes these sightings seem to group in certain locations. And in the investigations, the investigators kept noticing that a lot of these sightings and paranormal occurrences, paraphysical beings, if you will, who could appear and disappear, sometimes beings, hooded figures with glowing eyes and such, very unusual episodes. And they were appearing around these ancient stone chambers located at there in the Hudson Valley, New York State. And so, you know, it was also found that these areas had intense magnetic anomalies at these and other sites that have been investigated. There's a man from New York who's investigated these and sites all across the United States and other parts of the world, including Stonehenge and temples down in Central America, that have unusual electromagnetic or magnetic, geomagnetic energy pulses. And one of these I recently visited with a Native American medicine woman of Apache ancestry out in near Albuquerque, New Mexico. And this was a site that John Burke had said was his instruments had showed he'd gotten the strongest and most unusual readings he'd gotten anywhere. And we went there, and it was quite an interesting experience. It's like this ridge that goes on for about 17 miles, and it's over 20,000 different kind of petroglyphs going back hundreds of years. And Priscilla Wolf is the Native American I was talking about, who's also had UFO close encounters and contact experiences going back to her childhood. And her grandmother used to, who was full-blooded Apache, used to tell her many stories about the star people and the visitors from other worlds, and where she was from in the San Luis Valley, which is considered sacred by many different Native American groups, was considered sacred grounds. There was a lot of things, a lot of activity, and she said there was a doorway to other worlds, which sounds like kind of a stargate or something, right near where there's an extinct volcano, which also this site near Albuquerque is volcanic rock. This ridge was formed by volcanic activity thousands of years ago. And so maybe the magnetic fields or whatever that's, because I could take a compass, and of course the rocks are very, very magnetic. And so, in fact, while we were walking up this ridge, Priscilla even got like an electric shock while she was putting the plastic cap on her little plastic water bottle. And she yelled, you know. So it was quite interesting, quite an interesting visit, and it really opens your eyes, and I was thinking to myself, I wish John Burke was there with all of his scientific equipment to have checked out this extinct volcano near Priscilla's hometown, the San Luis Valley of Colorado, where we went, because she said that there were stories going back to the early 1900s, and there was even a Ute Indian that her and her family knew who used to tell about encounters with flying discs and things and being taken, you know, and there were incredible, unusual stories about huge black dogs with fiery red glowing eyes and the phantom hitchhiker and just all sorts of strange, paranormal, interdimensional sounding things.
All sounds really interesting. But I like stuff like this. The other thing, Brent, now, you talk about Peru. Have you been to Peru, South America?
No, I haven't. That's something I would like to do one day, but I have had contact with a gentleman who is native from Peru and has had encounters down there and has also is working as a civilian consultant with the Peruvian Air Force, which, again, they're more open, it seems, with their information and so forth than our own military has been. I think they're another one that's trying to, you know, help out with the civilian efforts to, you know, and let the people know what's going on as much as they're able to. Perhaps with our own military, it's a matter of, not wanting to admit that there's something going on that they can't explain, you know,
mm-hmm.
or fully understand. And from a military standpoint, that might be, you know, an undesirable thing, quite undesirable if you've got something that seems to be able to freely enter your airspace and you can't, you don't know what it is, and it's violating FAA rules and regulations. But I think a lot of the people in the countries have realized, too, that, enough is enough, and it's time to everybody to share their information and work together to see if maybe they can, their best scientists from all over the world might be able to review this data and maybe come to a better understanding. We're still holding out, I think.
Yeah, I think we are, too. I think it's really silly, but, that's kind of how they think they have to do things. I mean, because you hear about different sightings all different places. And every time you hear about a sighting, you also hear about what's called the Men in Black. Do you know anything about that?
The Men in Black, there was, you could trace them historically to parallels. The Men in Black in witchcraft lore, their stories about mysterious, there was in Wales back in, 1905, around 1905, there was a religious revival, and there were strange lights in the sky, and there was one story about, a dark-clad being, and this light came up and shot a beam of light at this figure, and it dissolved, and there were two witnesses that saw this. And as I was reading the account, this was 1905, and it was a spiritual revival situation, and I thought, in our day and time, that would have been a flying saucer shooting a beam at a man in black, and,
mm-hmm.
would have been more like a Star Wars mentality. But back then, it was entirely a spiritual frame of reference. And even the modern accounts, now I worked on a case in Maine back in 1975 that ended up having a number of MIB elements to it. And I was recently discussing this case with someone just the other day. We had two young men who had been out and saw craft, had missing time, and a lot of unusual psychic poltergeist-type activity following this event. And they were quite shook up, and so a hypnotist, who was a medical doctor, was found to conduct the hypnosis. This medical doctor, though, was also a spiritualist minister.
Okay.
And he had psychic experiences for some number of years. and some measure of ability and sensitivity. And he agreed. He had an open mind, so he agreed to conduct the hypnosis. And he did several sessions with a subject by the name of David Stevens, one of the young men. The other one decided he didn't want to be hypnotized. And after the sessions were, I think, completed, one day the doctor receives a telephone call from a gentleman who claims, he said, to be a UFO investigator from New Jersey and wanted to come by and discuss the case with him. So he said, yeah, sure, why not? So this unusual, tall, dark-clad man comes into the house and asks him to tell him, you know, the story about the case, and afterwards he says, that's what I thought. And after that, it seems like, you know, everything gets really bizarre. Instead of being just a ufologist, he goes into becomes an MIB. He tells the doctor that he has two coins in one of his pockets, and he reaches in and pulls out two coins, and he says, okay, place that penny in the palm of your hand and, you know, watch and see what happens. And it begins to glow and glows brighter and brighter and then just disappears. And the doctor wants to know, what's the meaning of this? And he says that, you know, that coin will never be seen by anyone on this plane. He doesn't say planet, he says plane, again. And then, of course, he warns him to destroy all of his tapes and all of his evidence, anything to do with this case. And then he walks away, and I think that he walked around toward the back of the house. It was like a flash of light, and the doctor ran out. He said there wasn't time for him to have disappeared, but he wasn't anywhere around. And so that's essentially the case. Now, David Stevens claimed the MIB visitation as well soon after the sighting. But there were a lot of paranormal, strange elements to these things. And doesn't sound like just, you know, ordinary. Of course, some of the MIB incidents may be related to people who are maybe investigators who just maybe going for the gothic look or something. And there may be some who are military, but then some of these cases are just very bizarre and of a kind of a paranormal twist.
What about Roswell? You know, we hear about Roswell all the time, and we hear about Area 51, and we hear that there's something there, but nobody can prove it. You know, they don't let you buy the site, and, you know, there's story after story after story that's been created through that.
Yeah, well, with Roswell, something happened back in 1947, there's no doubt, and I don't know. But what was interesting in interviewing Dr. Edgar Mitchell recently, he was as a young boy, he lived out there in Roswell, just a short distance from where this had occurred, and he said back then everyone was talking about it, you know, and there was really something that happened. And after becoming a famous astronaut, many people in the military approached him and told him stories, you know. They wanted someone to know before they died that there was something very strange that happened, and there was a cover-up, and they had been threatened not to talk about it. And so I can't say, but that impressed me that someone of Dr. Mitchell's integrity and background would... And he recently mentioned that on Larry King's show recently, too.
Mm-hmm.
Those same things.
Let's ask this a better way. A lot of people have claimed to be have been abducted. And they could be from all different parts of the world and not know each other, not even talk with each other, but they come up with somewhat of the same kind of description as to what happened, how they were lack of time, some stories that they come up with. Do you think that a lot of people who say they have been abducted, is it a possibility that their stories are really pretty much true and we just kind of, again, lump it all together like, well, this one says the same and this one says the same just so we can pass it by?
Well, yeah, there's historical parallels. The Native Americans and the Muslim Jim, there are stories that go back in these cultures about visitations from certain beings, abductions, sexual assaults, missing time, the little people, the fairy lore, the people having missing time in those cases that they may have been gone for years, the Rip Van Winkle effect. And then there are also differences, and it may be a cultural, social thing that needs to be explored too. In Peru, the people there have accused Americans, our American government, of manufacturing the abduction thing, because down there they've had encounters with beings who were more of the benevolent space brother, and they're not aware of any real evidence of people being abducted against their will. And in Brazil they've had some abductions, but from what I understand that they've not been quite the same for the most part as we've had. They tend to remember the entire experience, although some of them wish they hadn't, because there were stories of people being hit by beams of light and suffering physical trauma, and one guy even being grappled by something from underneath the UFO, like a tentacle type thing that wrapped around him and raised him up in the air, and apparently was going to take him up, and he managed to pull himself loose and fell into a thorn bush. But he was okay. He was just a little bruised up and bleeding some. And this was witnessed by someone else who happened to look out the window and see him falling to the ground from the direction of this UFO. And there were quite a number of stories like that that were investigated by an American journalist, Bob Pratt, who went down and looked into these stories. And I had interviewed him a few years ago for the magazine, and also a Cynthia News, who's an American, who lived not far from Rio de Janeiro for quite a number of years. And she used to work with Bob Pratt when he'd come down there, and she spoke Portuguese and would help to translate and would visit many of the witnesses in Brazil and help him to investigate these stories. So it's pretty awesome, and I know I was on the Jeff Rentz show with him and Brad Steiger a few years back, and I was talking about these different varieties of encounters and stuff, and this Jeff said that it sounds to him like different alien beings have kind of like gang lords. They've taken up this block. One group takes up this little section of the land, and someone else takes up this section, and they're all got their own agendas going or something. But if we're dealing with paranormal forces, interdimensional beings, I think it might also be, and this is just pure speculation, but it seems as though sometimes there's a kind of a reflective feedback effect from the phenomenon. It seems to adapt itself to people's expectations and belief systems. Mm-hmm. And I think to the Native American perspective, you had to be careful when you were going on the vision quest. The trickster was liable to be the first being that you encountered. And you had to learn to be discerning and to get beyond the trickster to get to higher spiritual truth and understanding. And maybe that's what we have to do. Maybe the surface appearances of these experiences. Maybe we need to try to understand some deeper realities that's behind it all, and keep digging a little deeper and to try to understand the underlying dynamics that may be behind and may account for why one culture perceives it one way and another culture sort of perceives it a little differently.
Monsieur, I cannot believe that we would be the only human beings of some sort in this entire universe that we don't even know what's even out there yet.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. It's, there's, you know, I have to agree with Carl Sagan and all the others, you know, there's all these billions of stars out there and all the same elements. And, of course, life can also exist in other conditions that we can't even hardly imagine, so.
Mm-hmm.
But then with the UFO phenomenon, it's been here just like forever since human memory can be traced back, you know, recorded legends and stories, and the same kind of patterns seem to be, you know, I mean, a lot of people associate the UFO phenomenon beginning with Kenneth Arnold and Roswell back in 47, but you can research this thing going back further and further and further, and there are all kinds of stories, and, you know, people have also speculated on the biblical stories of, you know, Ezekiel's wheel and things, too. And the similarities to UFO encounters. So I think the details are all there. We've just got to try to figure out, again, what it all means ultimately. And of course, a lot of people suffer what the psychologist calls cognitive dissonance. We just don't want to deal with things that we can't put a solid label on, that we can't really say we understand. You know, it's just...
Mm-hmm.
Everybody likes a mystery up to an extent, but then they like to know what they're dealing with. and this is one of the most, you know, challenging of mysteries here, this UFO thing. It's there, it's seen over and over again, it's a recurrent phenomenon, and it comes in, you know, it's here, it's there, but it's difficult to nail it down to say exactly what it is.
I've always been fascinated with the movie producers, how they can come up with some of these ideas, like Star Wars, for example. You know, it's a very popular series, and yet when I sit there and I watch it, you know, in my mind I go, well, how can this person come up with all of this stuff if, one, he hasn't experienced it himself, or two, he has not talked to somebody who maybe has experienced some of this? Because, I mean, it was way ahead of its time, you know, just like E.T. was. That was way ahead of its time, you know, the Close Encounters one. Those were way ahead of their time, you know, from what we know. And so it's always fascinated me with, you know, where it came from, you know. So, you know, I find UFOs, you know, the whole theory of them very interesting because, like I said, I do not believe that we are the only things that have a mind and know what to do or try to live, you know, in the universe we're in.
Right. Well, certainly there are a lot of people, and Dr. Hynek said that, well, I believe it was Dr. Hynek, that if extraterrestrial beings came down and visited us, their science would be like magic to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can just imagine going, you know, if we were to visit people, you know, just not that many years ago, and they could see the kind of things that we have, the television, the computer and all, and the cell phone, my goodness, they would think we were some sort of devils or something, or angels or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's also
some people's theory that after the supposed crash in Roswell, that's when we all of a sudden developed many, many new things that we didn't have before. You know, like the microwaves and lasers and things like that.
Right. Right. And you know, I also happen to think that we're pretty ingenious beings, but then who's to say that perhaps these encounters, there hasn't been some sort of, you know, knowledge that's been transferred. I mean, you know, people who have had UFO encounters, close encounters, contacts, things develop a lot of times at a psychic level. Sometimes it's not handled right. It's detrimental to the person. Other times they seem to evolve more intellectually and spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been scientists who have had close encounters and seem to be on the verge of making important scientific discoveries. And so who's to say that something wasn't going on there, you know, that helped certain people. And, of course, you know, you mentioned science fiction. Whirley Strieber was certainly a well-known science fiction writer who later wrote Communion about his own, you know, abduction experiences, contacts, interactions with he and his family with strange alien visitors. And there was another one that was also a science fiction writer that my brain is not able to remember his name at the moment, but he has since passed away. But he had written to Brad Steiger, and they were he certainly described having a lot of psychic paranormal abilities and insights, and things that would come true, and he would have visions that he incorporated into his science fiction writings and scenarios, and he felt that some of it was going to happen and was true. So it's interesting.
The other thing with all the people that I talk to, and I'm sure you talk to also, Brent, there are a lot of people out there who are into the psychic world, let's say, psychic medium, and they talk about how very soon, and I do mean very soon, that we are going to have so many different visitations from UFOs that all of a sudden our government is not going to be able to try to cover it up anymore. What is your theory on that one?
Well, I was talking with someone not too long ago, and they said it's not a question of getting more evidence. There's just ample evidence. There's just too much of it sometimes. We should already really be at that point. You know, I mean, how much more do you really need to convince yourself, to convince anyone that with all the people who have, you know, come forward, the hundreds and thousands of cases, and I mean, yeah, sure, that misinterpretation of natural phenomena accounts for the majority of the cases, but when you have qualified observers, airline pilots, astronauts, police officers, and military personnel, and really sometimes even, you know, the stories of children and peasants, their incredible stories that they tell are even just as impressive right alongside those of, you know, the so-called qualified observers because they're so pure and straightforward. How much more do you need? Of course, who wouldn't like to have, one of the flying saucers right there at ground level? You know, of course, shut the engines down so we don't get radiated and just be able to go over there and kind of kick the tires, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, maybe some governments have that already, you know, but of course we don't.
No.
We don't know that for sure. We don't have access to it, but...
We will. At some point in time, we will, because it's all headed that way. The other thing, you don't just talk about UFOs and you don't just write about UFOs. You talk about some of the other phenomena that's going on, like Bigfoot, for example. That's been around for eons and eons and eons, and yet people still try to say it isn't true. They try to misprove it. They send people out to find them. And I don't listen to the news very often because it's just not my thing, but somebody was just talking, and I don't even know where it was, about these huge footprints that have just been found. And they're not sure what they are, but they're going to, of course, investigate them. So do you think the theory of Bigfoot, that there is a Bigfoot or there's not a Bigfoot, or it's just a, you know, scary nighttime story to tell, you know, to kids?
Well, my interest in the Bigfoot thing came about really for me because I linked the UFO with the Bigfoot phenomena too, for whatever connection there was. I came across the case back in 76, and part of the story even ended up in the National Enquirer. There was an investigator from New York who came down. I met him, and we were both talking with witnesses. And let's see, this was here in Tennessee. It was probably about 80 miles to my east of me, near Fayetteville. And it was out in a rural setting, and there were a number of homes that this Bigfoot activity seemed to have been going on. People were terrified, some of them in the community, although some people felt, you know, now there's nothing scary. It's not really harming anyone. In fact, I talked with this elderly woman who put food out for it, breadcrumbs. And but there was a young child that it lunged toward, and some of the people thought it was trying to abduct the child. And so by the time I arrived on the scene, there were, people coming around, and there was that get your rifles, we're going to go after this thing mentality. But I kept going back for a number of years, just kind of checking on things. And there was a gentleman who was very reluctant to talk about this with me in the beginning. And he even told me, he says, this just doesn't go along with my beliefs as a Christian, so I'm not going to talk about it. But I knew he'd seen some lights.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, you know, a year or two later, I went back and we talked, and he forgot that he wasn't going to talk to me about this, and he proceeded to tell me, you know, he says, every time that creature was around, we'd see these little balls of light, little phosphorescent basketball-sized lights just on the tops of the trees. But one night there was 15 of us out there, and there was those balls of light. And he says, one night we had this meteor. I says, oh, man, I thought we were going to get up the next day, and there was going to be a big meteor in this field over here. So we watched this thing for an hour and a half, made a hissing sound, lit the air up as bright as day. I mean, did I say an hour and a half? It was a minute and a half, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it made a hissing sound. And I didn't tell him any different, you know, but a meteor lighting the area up bright as day and coming down in this field and making a hissing sound and being a whole minute and a half, that's just not right.
No.
So anyway, and then there was a situation back in, 1977, I was called in on a case in New Jersey, and it was a rural-type area. And there were people seeing Bigfoot there. There was also reports of UFOs. And one gentleman told me that he had he was out walking one night. He heard the footsteps behind him. He turned around and he said he swears he was only like 18 inches face to face with a Bigfoot. And he had his flashlight aimed in his face, and the creature sort of just staring at him, and he was froze. He didn't know what to do. And he said, this whole time there was like a pinpoint of light making a whistling type sound located behind the creature in the woods. And then he said the light went out, and he suddenly didn't feel frozen anymore. And he turned around, went running, and the creature just turned around and walked in the other opposite direction from him. So they said it was like they were both kind of, didn't know what to do and frozen in their places there while this light made this sound. And there was an investigator who, in Florida, I went to visit and went out in the field with her and her husband, and she was initially convinced that it was, you know, this was not related to UFOs. And then she admitted later, said, yeah, she took me around to places where they'd had sightings and said she was convinced that there was a connection. So, and I've been to Stan Gordon's home up in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, where he's got all these plaster casts. He's investigated all kinds of cases, and in 1973 they had a wave of hundreds of sightings, and in many of these cases they were Bigfoots. He had a multiple witness encounter that involved police, where that all these people had seen this object come down, land. Two creatures were seen coming out. They were shot at, the creatures. One of them was apparently hit because it cried out. And then there was like a smell of sulfur. The area where this UFO had been seen on the ground glowed for a while. One young man began to act, began to make growling sounds, and they thought he was possessed. A lot of very strange stuff was going on.
It sounds like it. Sounds like it'd be fun to investigate it, though, too, huh?
Uh-huh, yes, absolutely.
Now, there's a person by the name of David Icke who talks about the reptilian race. Do you know anything about that?
I've encountered a few people who have had stories about, you know, reptilian beings, but I don't know a great deal about it, really. You know, it's I don't really, other than just what everybody has already said. I do know there was one gentleman right here in Tennessee who told me that he had seen he had his television set on and was watching it, and I guess all the other lights were out, and he was walking in front of his television. He'd had different alien encounters, but he had never seen any of these. His were the grays mainly, but not so much the reptilians. But he said he was walking in front of the TV, and on the wall opposite from the television, he said, "How can this happen?" He saw his shadow in the shadow of a reptilian being. He said it was unmistakable. And he said, you know, sent chills.
I would imagine.
And he turned around, you know, like, oh, my God, you know, and there was nothing there. But there was the shadow, you know, and he thought, well, how can they be, you know, there and cast a shadow but not visible to your, you know, directly.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, this person who's had all sorts of experiences, he says, of abductions and things, also has a lot of paranormal things that have happened, and is now, in fact, a ghost hunter. He's really into ghost hunting.
That would prove to be fun, too, I think. Now, you also talk about the pre-Columbian, Peruvian whistling vessels. What is that?
Well, there are different cultures in Peru going back to 500 B.C., and some evidence of even earlier, and they right up until the arrival of the Spanish, these different cultures for hundreds of years made these whistling vessels, and a number of the researchers who have studied this believe that they were shamanic. They were probably used in various ceremonies, and a lot of them have effigy type figures, people, animals.
Mm-hmm.
And when you blow a lot of these whistles in unison together, a lot of people report that they enter a very deep altered state, and sometimes have very profound experiences, insights, sometimes even visionary out of the body type experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I was recently, when I was out in Colorado back in August, I spoke at the UFO Watchtower conference, and there was a, you know, I had the whistles with me, about three, and I passed them around at the end of my talk, and I said, now let's see, this is an authentic shamanic experience you can have a little taste of here. And so I, you know, gave them instructions and just, you know, how to blow them, and just we blow them a few minutes, and then afterwards just relax and just see, you know, everybody just wanted to share anything, tell what they experienced. And there was one woman who had been to the Monroe Institute in Virginia and had gone through these different courses using the hemisync technology, the binaural beats, and which, you know, is another method of altering consciousness with sound. And she said she was so impressed because she suddenly found herself within a few minutes of time at this very deep level that she had come to experience over, you know, a long time of study using the Hemisync technology of, you know, the Monroe Institute. So in the September issue of my online magazine, Alternate Perceptions, she did contribute. I asked her to contribute her thoughts on this and her experience, and it's quite an interesting article. It would be better probably if readers, if they want to check it out, just go to the September issue of Alternate Perceptions and and read that particular article on the Whistling Vessels.
Brent, give out that website again, please.
Okay, it's www.mysterious-america.net.
Okay. Do you know anything about the theory of the crystal skulls that's now surfacing again?
Well, I've heard a theory that that one day there will be, you know, I think 13 of these crystal skulls brought together from, you know, ancient cultures, maybe around the world, and that they will be placed in a circle, and, you know, they will communicate at that point great knowledge and information to the people present. You know, there's, like everything else, there's a lot of legends and stories. It's fascinating. Some of it turns out to be, you know, a hoax. And then the other parts of it, you say, wow,
mm-hmm.
I think there may really be something to this one, you know. I'm still kind of holding out on this one. I really think that there is something to it, but I just don't have anything solid myself. But I'd like to know more.
Yeah, I saw, again, I don't watch a lot of television, but there was something on there about the discovery of the 13 crystal skulls. And it was actually a documentary. I think it was on Discovery Channel, but of course wherever they went, they did not get the chance to find the other one. Supposedly there's one missing. And everybody seems to be searching for that, and that's what they're waiting for, to bring them all together. You know, and the rest of the theory is exactly what you said is what I've heard. I have another question for you, though, Brent. What about the lost city of Atlantis? Has it been found?
My co-editor, Dr. Greg Little, and his wife, Laura, have spent many years now diving down around the Bimini Road, and they've discovered some other sites not previously mentioned. They just come out with a documentary. They're at, in fact, this weekend they're at the Association for Research Enlightenment's Ancient Mysteries Conference, where they're doing a presentation over in Virginia Beach, Virginia, the Edgar Cayce Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a video just out called The Search for Edgar Cayce's Atlantis. And this is a review of all their work so far, which is still ongoing, up to earlier this year when they were again down in the Bahamas and doing, you know, underwater studies. But they have, if you watch the videos and read their books, they have really, and of course a lot of this information is also available on our website, demolished the whole notion of the Bimini Road and so on, these formations just being natural geological formations. There's every indication, in fact, there's been stone anchors that have been found there, that there's man-made, that these are man-made harbors, ancient harbors. And they're very similar to European harbors from, you know, the Greeks and so on had many centuries ago. And there are certain geologists who have opposed this evidence, and Greg and Laura have been there, worked with an archaeologist who has come to believe that these are genuine, that it is these are man-made ancient harbors. And maybe, you know, what Edgar Cayce said, that in 1969 the traces of Atlantis would appear in, you know, that area. And sure enough, in 1969, people did begin to, you know, after the Bimini Road was discovered, maybe this is it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly feel that it is, whether it's related to Atlantis or not, this is something that the archaeological community definitely needs to, you know, really seriously look at, and that there's all sorts of indications, and they've got they're not just talking about this, stating their opinions. They've actually gone there and been diving and photographing, and they've even, as a result, come up with other sites that are similar to the Bimini Road that we didn't know about previously. They've also explained a lot of things that we thought were anomalies that turned out to be coral reef formations and things. But then there's these other things that look like ancient harbors.
Mm-hmm.
And quite fascinating. And it fits the location of where Plato said, Atlantis should have been.
Mm-hmm. Kind of neat. We're almost out of time already.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I have another question to ask you just real quick, and we have to do it real quick because we only have like a couple minutes. I want to know about the Bermuda Triangle. Is it a place that people actually do disappear, or, do they just get lost and then never found? What do you think about that real quick?
Well, I've been through the Bermuda Triangle a number of times, and other than witnessing St. Elmo's fire, nothing really strange happened to me, but that was pretty phenomenal to me, but of course it's a natural phenomena. But Philip Imbrogno, in a book that just came out called Interdimensional Worlds or something, I don't know, I can't remember for sure, but it's Philip Imbrogno, and he was the New York UFO researcher who worked with Dr. Hynek on those Hudson Valley sightings. And anyway, he's done research on the Bermuda Triangle, and it really, even earlier accounts from back around the time that Columbus and other explorers were coming over, and the things that they reported were pretty bizarre and frightening. So
we will. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, anyway, I just recommend that people interested. His book just came out this year, and it's Interdimensional Something, and wow, it's thought-provoking.
Do you think, Brent, as time goes on and people really start to open up a little bit more, because there's going to be things happening here, and everybody's worried about, the 2012 thing. My guides, my angels have told me since I was a child that it's 2010, not necessarily 2012, but things will keep going. But so say from 2010 on, that there's going to be a lot of discoveries, a lot of different, energies that come into play that people really are not going to be able to, say, oh, it's just a fluke. So, knowing that and using like the Maya calendar, what do you perceive that when the Mayan calendar ends, that people are going to find, or is the Earth going to just blow apart, which I doubt? What is your theory on that?
Well, I doubt it's going to blow apart either. I think I try to take a more optimistic view, and I don't want to get involved in all this hysteria. I think that, it's the end of the world. It's the end of a cycle. In that terms, it was the end of the world. It was the end of that world, and then the beginning of another cycle, another world. And I don't think that they meant that it was, in their calculations that we should put all this fear and dread. It was like people's reactions when, the year 2000 rolled around and, all the computers and everything were, they were afraid were going to shut down,
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen either. So I think we're just going to, but I do think that a lot of knowledge is accelerating. All this technology and stuff, I've got to really struggle to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
And the discoveries that are being made in science and, but I don't think there's going to be anything bad. I believe that it's going to be good for us. Of course, there's a lot of things we've got to really address that are critical. The whole overpopulation, the dependence on fossil fuels, and and things are kind of in rough shape in the world right now. But I think this is, it can be an opportunity, or it can be bad.
Yeah, I think I think that a lot of people, you know, because it's been such a big thing to talk about how the Maya calendar ends on 2012, that there's going to be total doom and gloom and, you know, things are going to just, you know, vanish and on and on and on and on. And I really don't think that that's what it meant, like what you're saying, Brent. I really think that it's going to be the end of the world as we know it because it has to change. I mean, you know, we are destroying this planet. We are not taking care of it. It's a living, breathing thing, and it's going to survive no matter what we do or don't do. It's going to survive. Whether it survives with our help or it eliminates a lot of us, it's still going to survive. And I think the doom and gloom theory that everybody, you know, first was predicting, oh, because the calendar ends, it's going to be the end of the world. I don't ever see it like that.
No, I don't either. And it's, you know, I remember reading once where one Native American culture believed that their elders should try to prepare for the next generations, their lives, sort of line things up for the next seven generations. And I don't think many of our political leaders in Washington, D.C. are really focused that way. It would be nice if they were.
Yeah, not at all. You know, I think that if we had our chance, Brett, to go back to some of the way that we actually liked our neighbors, liked our families, and helped each other, it would be so much more helpful for the entire world, and there would be a much better survival rate for everybody and everything. But somehow it appears that the people have forgotten about how to love yourself, love your neighbors, love your family. And that part bothers me because without that, it's going to be kind of tough, you know, to get through some of these times that are coming. I mean, there is going to be changes. You know, when you read the books, you hear about how there's another planet circling around and it's got its own magnetic pull, so that's what's going to make the Earth tilt. And, you know, there's all kinds of theories. And if the Earth tilts, then there's going to be the different platelets of land shifting, and so a lot of land is going to go underwater, just like what Edgar Cayce had seen in some of, you know, his, you know, stuff when he was in his transit state. So knowing that Edgar Cayce came up with a map of the world, have you had a chance to see that?
I know a map of the world.
Then it's like his idea when he was channeling how the world was going to look as a lot of the platelets shift. But, of course, that's not what they were called in his time. But it shows, like, the land that is not going to be here and is going to be taken over by a lot of water.
Yeah, well, I've heard it. I haven't seen the map, but I've heard of how, you know, there was going to be water in a lot of places where there isn't right now. And some other people have been predicting similar things as well. A little bit different, but they've also made maps. And I can see where, you know, over time, I mean, there's right where I'm living right now, billions of years ago, there was ocean. A place nearby called Clifton was beachfront property with what we would call sea serpents. Right now, there was a monstrous sea creature with fins that was about 20-25 feet long, as they've found fossils of out there in this flat land of Tennessee just to our west. So we know that the Earth does, you know, evolve through changes, and things are, you know, these things are possible, but hopefully we'll have enough warning and pay attention, and our scientists can get us through it.
That would be nice.
Yes, it would.
That would be nice. Now, you talk about monsters. There's also that theory about the Loch Ness Monster, and they've never really proved it or disproved it.
No, but they've had a lot of compelling eyewitness testimony, and of course, one thing that always impresses me is not just Loch Ness, but there are lots of other lakes and bodies of waters around the world where similar things have been seen. From where I'm from, originally I'm from Maine, and up in New England, is between Vermont and New York, there's Lake Champlain, and they have what they call Champ, which is a creature very similar to the Loch Ness Monster. And there's another one up in Canada, and I saw something on TV about one in Japan recently. that people there have been seeing. And of course, the ocean is always, there's always been stories of sea monsters, and we've dismissed them as old tales. But back in 1975, or maybe it was 1976, anyway, I was down in Florida and Jacksonville area, and there was a story that came out, and I called a couple of the witnesses on the telephone, talked with them. There were five witnesses total out on a boat that claimed that this creature with a long neck came up out of the water and, you know, scared the chickens out of them. And they sounded, you know, very serious and sincere and credible. And I've heard that there have been other sightings in the St. John's River that, you know, flows into the Atlantic Ocean down there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that there has to be something to it because, again, you know, this planet has been here for a very long time, and they keep discovering different things that they didn't think exist anymore, and it does. I mean, they're always discovering some kind of a reptile in some part of the country. It's like, you know, hundreds of thousands of years old if you listen to what they tell you. So, I mean, there's got to be some truth to some of the, quote, theories that people are putting out there because there's just too many unexplained things that, you know, we still, in our little vivid imagination or mind, whatever you want to think with, you know, we don't want to believe some of these things, and yet it's put right in front of our face almost the, our whole life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I would love to hear tomorrow, tonight, or just whenever, it would be great to find out that, oh, they've discovered a Bigfoot, or, you know, without doubt, or someone has actually, you know, got a Loch Ness monster in a big aquarium tank, you know, to have the proof positive. I was interested in dinosaurs as a kid, and I remember hearing a report on the radio about someone seeing a sea serpent, and I remember welcoming that news, you know, excitedly, thinking, oh, boy, they really do still exist. They're still out there, you know. But as I found out as I grew up, that's an ongoing controversy. There's no real scientific solid proof yet, but I'm still looking.
Brent, do you think with our technology now, with the DNA and stuff that we can get and how they're taking it off of, like, different fossils and stuff, that actually is going to give us some better answers to some of the questions that, you know, we're kind of looking for and we don't think there's a real answer, but it is going to be proven one way or the other?
Yeah, I think DNA evidence is already establishing migration patterns and things that we didn't realize, you know, about, or, you know, if you're talking about where we've been and who was here and so on in the past. Of course, there are those frozen mammoth elephants, too, that there's traces of DNA that people talk about maybe taking and they can find one preserved well enough and adding it sort of like in Jurassic Park and recreating the Jurassic world. I don't know. I may just got loopy on that one, but that's exciting to think that, you know, these things are possible.
I think the theory that just about anything is possible really ought to be what people kind of focus on, because basically it is. You know, we don't know our total history. You know, we don't know the universe total history. We don't know what lies beyond, you know, quote, our universe. I mean, to me, it's like never ending. And there's, again, there has to be many, many things out there that at some point in time, it's all going to come together, whether we're still alive when it happens or not. But I think at some point in time, it will, you know.
Well, I think it's just, you know, scientific intellectual snobbery just to dismiss all this out of hand just because it doesn't sound doesn't fit into your belief system when, you know, they're not, if you're not going to get out and actually talk to the people, investigate it, see if it sounds credible, you know, check out these stories and actually do some first-hand investigations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what some of the people that I've I've worked with, I'm proud to say that, you know, they have actually done that, like Dr. Berthold Schwartz, who's a psychiatrist who, instead of being like a lot of psychiatrists, you know, just, you know, with a wave of the hand, dismissing it all as mass hysteria and psychological delusion, went out there and talked with psychics and talked with UFO witnesses and wrote what New York journalist John Keel calls one of the best UFO books, called UFO Dynamics, which was two-volume, over 500 pages, but is full of case after case after case of people he interviewed in different states and at length, and who, although they describe these incredible encounters with UFOs and strange beings, the details were correlations from one case to another, curious correlations, and they were mentally, emotionally sound of mind and stable people. So, you know, he couldn't dismiss it. He didn't have a flying saucer he'd go out and kick, you know, the tires on, but going just looking at the, you know, the testimony, talking with the people, you know, he found a great deal of credibility in what they had to say. In every other aspect of life, what their testimony in a court of law would have stood up if they were testifying in someone in against someone in a criminal case. So why not a UFO case as well?
Mm-hmm. The pyramids over in Egypt, they're always fascinating for a lot of people because they got a lot of great mysteries behind them. Even on the pyramid walls, they show different things like spaceships, stick figures with helmets on them. And they've been there for a long, long, long time. When it comes to the theory of building the pyramid, even today, with all the technology that we have, we cannot construct a pyramid like what was constructed back then. Do you think that they actually had all of those humans constructing them? Do you think they had a different technique that they may have used, like levitation? How do you think that happened?
That's a fascinating subject. The possibility that some of these ancient people somehow employed levitation. There was a doctor, and I'm sure you've heard the story, back in the 1920s or sometime, who was over in China or near Tibet, and saw a bunch of monks at the base of this mountain, and they had all these horns, these different instruments of sound that they had, and there were these rocks, and they would make their sounds, and I think they had drums too, and the gong, and using the sounds in the right sequence, they were able to move these rocks and to levitate them. And this medical doctor, I think he was from England, wrote a statement claiming that he'd actually witnessed this happen. They have been able, on a very small scale, move little particles using sound. Nothing yet as grand as this, but I spoke with Andrew Collins, who's a science writer from England, who has written on ancient mysteries and is very fascinated with the study of mentions in a book that he wrote about acoustics and things at ancient sites, and how he, you know, wonders if maybe there wasn't something to this. So it's
the great minds, we'll call them the great minds of, say, the pyramid time. I've often wondered how, if they did it by sound, where it came from to begin with. Because, you know, you just don't wake up one morning and say, okay, I'm going to use sound, I'm going to levitate a huge stone. It just doesn't work like that.
Yeah. obviously, we've had, I would say it's, you know, we're seeing more and more indications that there were civilizations going back much, 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 much further in time than we have any idea, but the traces of them have been just lost to us, you know. Atlantis, maybe just one in a vast variety that we just don't even, you know, have any idea. And of course, there are stories that a number of them appear to be quite credible, and there's been books written about these kind of incidents where in chunks of rock and coal that artifacts, man-made artifacts have been found in rock and in strata that would have dated it back millions or thousands of years ago and should not have been there, you know. And yet, there they were. Various, you know, tools and a lamp in one case and just different artifacts.
You know, I always find this real, you know, actually a lot of fun because I have a mind that can just wander any place it wants to go. And I don't try to halt it, okay? because if you don't halt it, I mean, it's unlimited potential in every phase of life, okay,
mm-hmm.
if you don't halt it. But our thing is, mm-hmm. our logic mind says, no, that can't be real. So we have a tendency to shut everything down. So if people would just allow their mind to just go wander around, do you think that maybe more people might be a little more convinced that anything is just about possible?
Yeah, I think we need to encourage creative individual expression more than we have. I think we tend to look to others for the answers. We tend to look to, the pastor, the church leader, to have all the answers. And I've talked to a number of people who had UFO encounter abduction experiences and things who were suddenly found out they were very disappointed in their leaders, you know, because they didn't have the answers except to say, you need to go see a psychiatrist, you know, a big letdown. And I think everybody has this curiosity. I notice with the presentations I do with the Peruvian whistling vessels, I can take that. I can go into a New Age group or a UFO group or a group at, say, the fitness bar that we have nearby here, and I can do a presentation. And on different levels, wow, you know, it's suddenly acceptable to talk about things you couldn't previously talk about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because here you have something that everybody can see and experience, and so it's suddenly okay. And I realize that everybody has this curiosity, and it's one of them, but a lot of times they're held back. They're afraid, you know, to play with it and to, you know, be creative with it and to kind of do this intellectual exercise because they're afraid that it may be a bad thing socially. There may be social repercussions, you know. Well, so-and-so goes to this church, and you know what he was doing and talking about? You know, and the word gets in. You know, I live in a small southern town. We're in the Bible Belt here. And so I've already been told I'm going to hell, you know. And we've had a sweat lodge on the hill behind our house in years past, and it was funny. My wife, who's part Native American, we talked to some Jehovah's Witnesses who would come and you know, talked about this. And we found out later that there was someone who told them a few miles from here that they, when they wanted to be close to God, they'd go out into the woods. And they said, well, we know some pagans over in Waynesboro. We knew that was us. We were the pagans. You know? We didn't necessarily, you know, we didn't go around calling ourselves pagans, but we suddenly found out, according to the Jehovah's Witnesses, we were pagans.
Oh, that's cute. The sweat lodge, let's talk a little bit about that, because Indians used to use those for different reasons. So why did you put your sweat lodge up?
Well, we had a Native friend, American friend, down in Alabama, who was of Cherokee Choctaw ancestry, and we began doing sweats with her back in '95, and we've now done about several dozen sweats, and we were doing it for purification to perhaps try to evolve more spiritually and to use it, you know, with spiritual intentions. And we got to the place where we were having these monthly sweats, and we would get down there to Alabama, which was quite a drive, and then we decided, was also quite a lot of work for this person to get each lodge ready and such, and to have wood available. So we decided that we would build one here on our property, and so we'd have one close at hand, and people would come to our house, and we could take care of some of that. So we did that, and we had some really interesting experiences, and you know, it's not necessarily for everybody, but it was very meaningful and a very positive experience for us.
A lot of times people go to sweat lodges. Like there was here in the Chicagoland area, there was a couple people that had them, and I went to one just, you know, to kind of see what it's about, because I'd not been to one, and I wanted to see what everybody was talking about. And one of their main purposes was to see if they could get all these visions coming in that, you know, they wanted to know so much about. And I didn't get to stay long enough because, of course, I had to go to work. But, you know, leading up to it, it was actually quite interesting because, you know, they would tell us about the whole history of it and why the Native American Indians used it and, you know, for their visions and then, you know, to purify themselves. And it was actually pretty interesting. And, you know, if somebody has not done it before they decide you're a pagan because of that, they might ought to want to try that and see what they get from it.
Yeah. Well, we had a number of people came to our house and experienced sweats for the first time, and it seemed to really, you know, be positive for most everybody. And everybody come away with something that they could use, I think, pretty much in their lives. There were some times I would go in and I'd be like, nothing happened. And then sometimes when I was really down and thought, you know, this isn't going anywhere, it was like suddenly something was showing me, pay attention to this. I had an experience that was just really probably too long to even go into, but the gist of it was that after we had the sweats, it seemed like sometimes when we were having a sweat, that somebody would have like a dream, or there'd be some like increased psychic activity going on around us. And we commented on that, I remember one time. And so anyway, after we had the sweats here at our house, I always remember just telling Joan, I'm just going to go down and sit by the sweat. It just seems like there's still an energy there, and I feel like I can tune in psychically. And I had the impression that there's a site I had heard about for some time down in Alabama. There's a number of sites, really, but there was one in particular I hadn't been to where there were petroglyphs. And I said, I have the impression that I need to go to this site, that there's a petroglyph that I need to examine that has some kind of meaning that I need to explore deeper. It's you know, something I'm supposed to find out about. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I made arrangements and went down there with a Native American friend, and we went to another site with petroglyphs, not, you know, it was also in Alabama, that we'd been to before, but it's also very, very, you know, very interesting, very sacred site to Native Americans. And then we went to this other one, this rock shelter that had petroglyphs, the one I felt was something there. Well, the first site, there seemed to be more activity going on than really at the second one, the one I thought I should go to. And a week later, I was in a sweat, and, you know, and I'd been kind of disappointed because I took pictures, I drew sketches of things that I saw there at that site, but I didn't see anything that really matched up, you know, that I could say, oh, okay, that was my impression, that's what I was supposed to see. Mm-hmm. So, about a week later, I'm in the sweat, but I think it was the second round, and I'm seeing a series of concentric circles, and I'm really a very analytical person. I want to see if I can analyze and explain it first before I, you know, let it enter into a belief system what something is. So I was saying, okay, something's happening to my optic nerve. These circles is something, you know, that's happening because of all the heat. And just as I thought that, all of a sudden, right before my closed eyes, in my third eye area, whatever, my visual field, there was it changed. It was phenomenal to watch. It turned into like a southwestern cactus, and I thought, whoa. And I immediately realized that this was also the same shape as what they call the turkey's foot, which was also at this site, the one I thought I was supposed to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, well, anyway, I didn't know what all this meant, but a few years later, I met this gentleman from England, Andrew Collins, who I mentioned a little while ago, a science writer, who also, years ago, back in the 70s, was also very interested in UFOs and had written a number of articles for Flying Saucer Review. And so we had a lot to talk about, and he was also really very impressed with the Peruvian whistles, which we introduced him to. And so we talked a lot about shamanism and things, and he had a book that was coming out, which I have now. It's called The Cygnus Mystery. And as he was talking, and then after reading the book, I believed anymore there were just a lot of parallels to what I found out on account of that turkey's foot. He also talked about the symbol of the bird's foot, the turkey's foot, that appears in cultures all around the world and has to do with this Cygnus star system. They call it the Northern Cross, which a lot of ancient cultures believe that we emerge from.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that there is a stream of gamma rays and cosmic rays that runs right through us from a neutron star or something that's radiating from there. And there's some speculation, even Carl Sagan back in the 70s speculated that that stream of energy could have also altered our DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's written this book about how our evolution may have been affected by this energy. Well, when we were at that first site, I was looking around, and I got the impression Southern Cross. Well, I found out in reading this book later that the Northern Cross was the Cygnus star system, and a lot of cultures, including the Peruvians, associated the Southern Cross as being a mirror image of the, and connected as a stargate with the Northern Cross.
Mm.
And I had seen, this whirling disc thing with a beam coming down and people hearing the sound from this thing and screaming and being terrified, and also people going under these rocks and sort of trying to astral project. And a lot of this made, seemed to make sense when I was reading the book. I didn't know where I was getting all these ideas from, but he describes how a lot of this energy was more intense back in the, 17,000 years ago when some of these ancient Neolithic work arts were done underground, that they would get down there and he believed that they could actually see some of this energy in the total darkness. And he also speculated that there were beings that they became aware of and that they were communicating things to these people. And they had these ceremonies going on underground in these caves, and they were drawing some of their, what we call today shamanic artwork and such.
Mm-hmm.
But I was comparing images he had, artistic images of the disc with the beam coming down, and what I was seeing at the time at this site of in my mind of some sort of a disc with a beam, except with his it was like a planet, a star, a neutron star with this jet of cosmic radiation coming out of it, which came, comes streams through in our direction. And so I thought, well, to me, all of it just kind of indicated that you can go into these, can follow the path of the ancients, follow some of these procedures, and actually learn things that are useful. I mean, the idea that for a long time I puzzled, why did I get the words Southern Cross, and
mm-hmm.
I kept looking in books I'd been reading at the time, and nothing about the Southern Cross came up, And then after I met this guy, there were just a number of things that just seemed to fall into place. Synchronicity or coincidence, or was it, you know, was it where my mind was supposed to be heading?
You know, a lot of times I think if people, again, just kind of open their mind and, you know, because everybody talks about meditation and how they can get real high, but there's other ways to doing it. You know, so if they just sit and open their mind just in general, I think a lot of people will understand, you know, better as to all of the different opportunities and options that are really going to be coming our way. So I kind of look forward to what's coming for the future, actually.
Yeah, yeah, you too. And also, I didn't mention this, but that same weekend that we were down at these sites in Alabama, my wife has since been seeing energy. And I thought that was a very interesting development. We can go to different places, and there's actually a place about 30 miles from us off the Natchez Trace that just over the line into Alabama, and there's an interesting gentleman of Yuchi Indian ancestry who has built a stone wall that's taken him years to build in honor of his great-great-grandmother, Tilane, who was a full-blood Yuchi. And she was like a healer, a medicine woman. And the energy is extremely evident to her a lot of times there. She can see the energy around the rocks and such. And this is not just any ordinary wall. You've got to see it. It's hundreds of feet long. And it's supposed to represent her journey. She was removed forcibly back in the 1800s to Oklahoma. And then she walked alone, on her own, back down here to the Muscle Shoals area of Alabama. Hundreds of miles on her own. Took her, I think, about 2 years. But
yeah,
she left a kind of like a written diary, and he's got that in his possession. He's written a book called If the Legends Fade. It's quite a remarkable book in telling her story.
That's kind of neat. Britton, can you give out your website again, please?
Sure. It's www.mysterious-america.net.
Do you know what some of your future things in your paper are going to be about?
Well, we'll be exploring a little more on, I'm sure, on the Native American element. And there's a Roswell story that we haven't told yet. When I was out in New Mexico recently with Priscilla Wolf, she had known about the so-called Roswell Stone for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
She got to hold it, and this particular artifact was discovered a few years ago some miles outside of Roswell by a hunter. Got unusual designs that are very similar to a crop circle over in England back in, I think, 96. Anyway, right after holding the stone, she said that she went back home and she had some visions and actually levitated off her bed about 2 feet.
Mm.
And I said, "Are you sure you weren't having a lucid dream?" She says, "No, I was physically levitated above my bed, and the ceiling of her room," she said, was no longer there. There were these energy balls that were revolving around and around, and she was floating up toward the ceiling that suddenly disappeared. And she said she clenched her fists, which is a trick that her grandmother had taught her years ago to resist the being taken forcibly, and she was able to break the energy, disconnect from it, and she walked back down in bed.
At least she landed on the bed.
Yeah. And everything returned to semi-normal again.
You mentioned the crop circles. Now, I know there's places and many people who have different opinions about crop circles. Most of them do not believe that the crop circles are done by anything out of this world, but in fact by a group of people who go around just doing them. Have you studied any of the crop circles or seen any of them or talked with anybody about them?
Yeah, I interviewed Nancy Talbert last year, who has traveled all over the world, and she's one of the experts on crop circles. And she's had, there's a site over in Holland that she's been to. And there's a young man who seems to be at the center of this activity. He has visions a lot of times, that dreams that tell him where something's going to happen. He goes there, and there's a crop circle. So he's got some kind of a psychic connection. Plus now, in recent years, he's been like a medium, a channeler. And she's been present when some very strange things have occurred. And initially, she was over there about 10 years ago, or maybe a little longer. And she described in the interview how this was not there before, but she was at the house. She was staying at this house where he lived, and she was up on the second floor, and her window looked out in the direction of this field, this large field. And all of a sudden, there was a bright beam of light just shining straight down. And she couldn't believe it, and she was running down the stairs, and the young man was running up the stairs, you know, because he'd seen it too. And they went outside, and she said she was a little cautious because, you know, this thing was so brilliant, you know, and was afraid, you know, don't want to get too close. And then I think, you know, it happened again, I think maybe three times. And they cautiously, when she looked up at the sky, there were stars, but she could not see anything that would account for where this light beam was coming from. But then there in the field, and it hadn't been there before, was a crop circle. And she was quite genuinely mystified. And she's been doing a lot of investigative work and getting a lot of studies done of scientific analysis, lab analysis of stalks of wheat and, you know, corn stalks and things studied in the lab that, like, sometimes have shown that, you know, the extended nodes or whatever, the little joints of the plants, that indication that they've been subjected to something like microwave radiation or something. And
mm-hmm.
She said sometimes the things that happen, there's just no explanation or known science for it, you know. She also worked with this John Burke who I mentioned has been going around to ancient sites and studying the energy configurations from the ground. And his work actually started in England with Nancy Talbert in around Stonehenge, that there were crop circles. And he began to check out, you know, the energy in the ground, and of course there's a lot of crop circles appear around over there, around some of these ancient places like the Stonehenge and Avebury. And so he went from one to the other.
That's kind of neat. I mean, I'm just like really excited because I know a lot of this is going to actually be proven, not just in theory, but actually proven. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to all of it.
Well, that's the exciting thing about, you know, people like Nancy Talbert and John Burke. Their studies are geared to trying to prove it, and they are finding a lot of anomalies and using scientific instruments and lab analysis to substantiate, you know, that there's something going on. And so it's really an exciting time.
Well, see, I think so. I think there's going to be more visits from other places, and we're just going to have to kind of like sit back and enjoy and see what we get to learn from them. I can't wait for that. You know, we've been talking for like an hour and 40 minutes.
Well, I was wondering. I'm sitting out on the back deck. It's dark. I'm listening to the frogs, tree frogs and such, and it's pleasant, so I've kind of lost track of time. I'm in the zone here.
That's a good thing. Anyway, I am going to let you go because I know that you're busy, but please, before you go, give out your website one more time. And if there's a phone number or email that you want people to contact you at, in case they have questions, you can give that out too.
Okay, well, they can contact me right at the website. I've got an email address there. Of course, my name is Brent Rains, and I edit Alternate Perceptions Online Magazine, and it's located at www.mysterious.com. Brent-America.net.
That's great. And Brent, one when the, I think it's Priscilla, is that the one we were talking about before?
Uh-huh.
When she starts to feel better, if we can get her on and interview her again with you, that would be great.
Oh, yeah. She has a lot of really interesting stories to share and knowledge to impart. And I'm hoping that she'll be up to par here pretty soon.
Well, we'd seem to send her a lot of energy to get her there. How's that?
Yes. Sounds great.
All right, Brent. Thanks for taking the time. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope my listeners have too, but I have. And again, you know, we'll have you back on, and we'll go over some other things. And if we can get Priscilla on it, that would be great too.
Okay. Well, I look forward to it. I've enjoyed talking with you, Nancy, and always enjoy talking with you. So, and thank you very much for this opportunity to share.
That's right, Brent. Thank you. You take care. Okay.
All right. You too. Now.
Great.
Bye bye.
Thanks. I'd like to thank you, all the listeners. I hope you enjoyed the show. May God bless all of you. Have a great week, and look for those flying saucers or those UFOs. It might surprise you. They may be right in your back door. Take care. Bye now.